Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name is Scott Lemieux, a longtime member and founder of LGM, as well as a lecturer in political science at the University of Washington in Seattle. And I'm pleased to be joined today by another familiar voice, Paul Campos, professor of law at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And today we might touch on a few other things, but we want to discuss in particular the legacy of John Paul Stevens, the Supreme Court justice who recently passed away at the age of 99 and is certainly missed in many ways, and is also very much representative of a politics that's completely vanished. And I guess maybe, Paul, maybe we should start there before discussing Stevens individually, is to sort of put him in the context of the sort of new elite polarization. And what I find remarkable about Stevens is not just that a Republican president nominated him, and a Republican president nominated Warren and Brennan in an era in which, you know, other political factors other than ideology played a role. It's that, you know, Ford remained immensely proud of having nominated Stevens his entire life. You know, one saying that if, you know, you judge my presidency on the legacy of having appointed John Paul Stevens, I'd be pleased. It's just, you know, definitely George H.W. Bush wasn't saying that about David Souter, for example. So, you know, I'm wondering, you know, if you have thoughts about the sort of, you know, the fact that, you know, one of the most liberal Supreme Court justices in history could be nominated by a Republican, and just how radically things have changed within our lifetimes.
Yes, it is absolutely remarkable. And one of the things about getting older, and I'm probably about 15 or 20 years older than you, I would guess. I'm 59. Is that time seems to telescope to a certain extent. And Gerry Ford's presidency is something that I actually remember fairly well. I'm from Michigan, and so was he. And I remember him talking about Stevens. And it does seem as if that is an utterly vanished world, even though it's one that, you know, for me autobiographically is a fairly close one. And it does, I think, signal what a profound sea change there has been in American politics over the last 40 years, as reflected by the extreme politicization and polarization of the federal judiciary in general and the Supreme Court in particular. Here again, let me wax autobiographical for a moment. I started in law school in 1986. At that moment, the Federalist Society barely existed. It had just come into being 3 or 4 years earlier. I believe some students at Yale and maybe Columbia started it. And then they started getting funding from, you know, from some right-wing groups, Olin and places like that. But in 1986, nobody in law school really knew what the Federalist Society was, because it really wasn't much of anything at that point. And again, that just doesn't seem that long ago. Yet in another way, as I think you're signaling, it was an immensely long time ago, because it was a completely different country. And Stevens's judicial career, I think, reflects that as well as anything.
Yeah, I think you know, one of the Scully, whenever I do a Supreme Court seminar now, which I do pretty much every year, I've started starting off with one of two articles by Mark Graber of Maryland. One of them, called Thaddeus Stevens's Constitution, was about how the framers of the 14th Amendment, other than Bingham, didn't really care about the wording of Section 1, because having been through Dred Scott, their opinion was pretty much, it doesn't really matter what we say. If we're not in charge of the court, the rights will be ignored anyway. But they were much more concerned about Section 2 and its command to Congress to take representation away from states that disenfranchised voters. Because they basically thought that, you know, however you write up the rights, all that really matters is who interprets them. So, you know, the framers of the 14th Amendment were actually much more sophisticated about law and politics than they're given credit for. And it's also, you know, trying to get the original intent of the Equal Protection Clause, the Due Process Clause, is sort of pointless, because what most of the framers thought was, you know, these abstract phrases will mean only what future Congresses and Supreme Courts make of them anyway. But the more pertinent one for us is another article you recently wrote called The Coming Supreme Court Yo-Yo. that a lot of scholars of judicial review have pointed out that the Supreme Court has generally been a centrist institution. You know, even when it's doing something really immoral like Dred Scott, it pretty much reflected the, you know, that was basically just the moderate view of Jacksonians at the time. The problem with Dred Scott wasn't so much the Supreme Court as that, you know, the Jacksonian Democratic Party was really committed to slavery and white supremacy. But more broadly, the Supreme Court rarely kind of strays from the views of political elites. And that's, you know, going back to Dahl, that's kind of become conventional wisdom. But the problem is that the idea that the Supreme Court was likely to be centrist, that's a little more complicated, sort of more libertarian both ways, but generally within the mainstream, is that this came from a time in which, elites were much less polarized than ordinary voters. So one reason that, say, Bill Brennan happened is that the difference between Eisenhower's Department of Justice and Truman's Department of Justice and Kennedy's Department of Justice was not actually all that great. You know, you had, you know, you basically in both of that, the Democratic ones were often surprisingly conservative, but there were sort of, you know, moderates, sort of within both. So that, you always had the center of the Supreme Court. Your sort of eccentric Democrats like Felix Frankfurter and Tom Clark, and then you had your country club Republicans, your Lewis Powells, your Porter Stewarts, O'Connor, with sort of Kennedy being the last and in many respects worst of the bunch. But now you're in a situation in which our political elites are actually much more polarized than ordinary voters. So there just cannot be a centrist median vote on the Supreme Court because those don't exist. Going forward for the foreseeable future, the median vote in the Supreme Court is either going to be a liberal like Kagan or Ginsburg, or it's going to be a conservative like Roberts or Alito, maybe even worse than that, quite frankly, if Gorsuch and Kavanaugh are any indication. So, you know, there's just, you know, that and a lot of, I think, of what allowed for a more congenial confirmation process was the fact that on issues the Supreme Court cared about, elites weren't always necessarily that far apart. There were certainly some sources of elite conflict, but often they didn't map super closely onto modern partisan arrangements. Think of three of Nixon's nominees joining Roe versus Wade, for example. So basically what happened with the Garland seat, given that context, was essentially inevitable. You know, at some point, a Senate was just going to say, we're giving up a huge amount of policy here. You know, why are we doing that? Let's just, you know, maximize the power to the maximum extent possible. That means not only no more Stevensons, but even no more O'Connors or Souters. And then I think that this elite polarization combines with your point about the Federalist Society, the point that Amanda Hollis-Brusky makes in her fantastic book about it, that, even if a Republican president wanted to appoint a suitor, where would they find one? there's this whole process to make sure they're weeded out of the process, you know, basically as two wells, let alone as federal appellate judges.
Yeah, they would need a time machine. I think the... one really striking example of how this has manifested itself over time that still has some effects in the state of the current Supreme Court, simply because of the sort of gerontocracy in which we have these extremely old people who went to law school 60 years ago, you know, when we had a completely different situation, is if you look back at like the legal process school, and specifically the legal process class at Harvard Law School that was taught by Henry Hart and Albert Sachs, that people like Antonin Scalia and Ruth Bader Ginsburg and other members of the Supreme Court went through, that whole school of thought was based on the notion that the political process ought to be based on sort of reasonable people coming to reasonable conclusions in a reasonable sort of way, with this kind of incantation of reasonableness that makes sense only within a situation in which you have a tremendous amount of ideological homogeneity. Because unless, you know, if the political spectrum is any wider than slightly center left to slightly center right, then the whole legal process language just doesn't make any sense at all. Yet these people, the people who until very recently dominated the Supreme Court, were people who were socialized within a legal culture in which talking in that way actually did make a lot of sense. Because as you say, The elites were not very ideologically heterogeneous, relatively speaking. That's why critical legal studies, like in the 1970s and 80s, caused such an uproar, because all of a sudden you had like some genuine left people saying, hey, you know, these ideas ought to be taken seriously. And the response was, well, we can't do that, because that would like undermine the rule of law. I'm not trying to be facetious here, because obviously this is a very serious subject. But as you say, what we're stuck with now is a situation in which the old mores simply don't work within the contemporary political culture. And the Garland fiasco was the inevitable reflection of that situation. And I myself don't see a way forward. I can't see how we get out of this situation given the current political landscape. And I fully anticipate that if a Democrat wins the presidency and the Republicans hold the Senate, we will not get any replacements for any Supreme Court justices until that situation changes. And that, I think, will potentially be a political crisis.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's enormously, you know, I guess it's a little complicated if, you know, it's Ginsburg or Breyer and it's not a meeting vote. But even then, I don't think so. You know, I think that as long as McConnell has a majority, I think that, and by the same token, as I think is implicit, if Hillary Clinton had won without Democrats capturing the Senate, I think we would right now have an 8-person court. And I think you would have to be delusional to think that Kennedy would have resigned under those circumstances, although we were supposed to pretend otherwise. Incidentally, it was interesting because you got a lot of pushback from commenters about your recent gerontocracy post, which is sort of inevitable, you know, because people obviously admire Ginsburg, and I don't think that's wrong in general. But there were sort of two, you know, there were a couple things that struck me about that. I mean, the first is that, sure, there's a certain dog bites man element to it. Like, I don't expect Supreme Court justices to insult other Supreme Court justices in public. And yeah, all Supreme Court justices are probably going to want norms, you know, that, you know, oppose court packing and so on. You know, I'm just finished reading the part in Stevens's very good biography where he talks about how his good friend Bob Bork, who served in the army, was treated badly, and sure, he was a complete wing nut after, but you know, maybe it would have been different. You know, and I sort of take that with a grain of salt, fine. But there, I think there are two things that should be pointed out. First of all, is that if it's something that they have to say as a matter of mores, they should carry no weight in public debate. So we should not care what any Supreme Court justice thinks about court packing because of their self-interest. But the other thing too is that on the point that you made about the irresponsibility of her not resigning in 2013 is that there is no norm that Supreme Court justices don't consider you know, partisan affiliations of the presidents when retiring. There's no norm at all. You know, going back to William Howard Taft saying that, you know, he wasn't going to resign under Hoover because he didn't want Bolsheviks to take over the Supreme Court, which he turned out to be wrong about about Hoover. But, you know, I think like Byron White, you know, made a point of staying on until Clinton was elected. Brennan and Marshall certainly would have if their health permitted, and they were very conscious of that. You know, it wasn't as if, you know, they didn't have any pious you know, belief that it didn't matter what president appointed them. And indeed, after he was finally forced off the court with Bush having approval ratings in the 90s, Thurgood Marshall made his famous comment about how, you know, my dad told me that, you know, if you get bit by a snake, it doesn't matter whether it's a black snake or white snake, you know, they both bite. You all know who that was directed at. You know, and for that matter, you know, Stevens and Souter, you know, both waited until Obama had won. And there's a real irony here in that those two Republican nominees actually cared more about the future of constitutional liberalism than Ginsburg and Breyer did, which I think also says something. But it really bugs me when people have these pious norms about the Supreme Court that don't reflect the actual behavior of the Supreme Court. And same thing. I mean, anybody who thinks Kennedy would have resigned if Clinton were president is, you know, that's just delusional. But so that in a sense, people want to think that, well, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a federal judge. She has to think that way. Like, that's not how federal judges think. They never have.
Right. The thing about the whole Ginsburg phenomenon that I find most annoying, really, is the reduction of the interests of the judiciary and really of the country as a whole to Ruth Bader Ginsburg's individual preferences. To me, this is just absolutely bizarre. Why it's okay that the fact that she doesn't want to resign makes it okay for her not to resign. I mean, I don't think we would treat other public figures in that way. We would insist that they do what's best, you know, for the country and for their political affiliation as they see it. And really, quite recently, it struck me that this kind of cult of RBG that has been built up over the last few years was, in some ways, it seems to me, a kind of conscious effort to give some kind of ideological cover for her personal selfishness. You know, that this kind of cult of personality where, oh, she's supposedly working out so much and, you know, she's this extraordinary figure in all these ways. And of course, she is a very extraordinary figure and a very admirable figure in all sorts of ways. But the long and the short of it is now we're in a situation where we are on the brink of a real catastrophe, of one of many, simply because she didn't do the right thing in 2013, 2014. And of course, as you yourself have said, the same thing applies to Breyer as well. And I think going forward, Supreme Court justices are not only going to have to be conscious, as they have been historically, as you say, about these kinds of considerations, but I think it's going to have to become much more overly strategic. I mean, if this is the system that we are going to continue to try to work our way through, then that means, you know, if you're 70, 73, whatever, and your party happens to be in control of the presidency in the Senate, you know, you should resign. I don't think that's really ought to be arguable at this point. I do think that that's how the Republicans are going to operate. I will say right now, I'm not predicting this, but I would not be completely shocked if Thomas resigns within the next year in order to give them another 45-year-old justice. And I do think that that's how things are likely to play out going forward. But to come back to sort of our original subject, I mean, this is a world which is completely alien to the worldview that John Paul Stevens grew up in. And I think that's terribly unfortunate because Stevens was a really conscientious lawyer above all. And he was a kind of a sort of craftsman who really cared about rule of law values and about liberal democracy writ large. He lived long enough to, you know, inhabit a world in which the good things that he stood for, to a large extent, just disappeared.
Yeah, and that's something that you really, you know, definitely, you know, and again, occasionally you have to get, you know, the occasional too pious thing. But, you know, Stevens really did care. You know, he was somebody who really took the job seriously, you know, was a real craftsman, you know, and his solo dissents and concurrences were never about vanity or anything like that. You know, that he was just really somebody who liked to think through these things. That's why he never liked being part of the cert pool and relying on other chambers to sort of make these determinations for him. You know, he was really somebody who just, you know, thought carefully about the law. And took that really seriously. And that's, you know, in terms of his historical legacy, you know, I mean, if you just look at his votes, you know, he would be one of the best from our perspective ever. You know, and unlike, you know, that, you know, sort of, you know, William Douglas would be the obvious other long-term liberal, and who was every bit as smart as Stevens, you know, was a, you know, extraordinary legal genius, but is also as well known, you know, often didn't take the job very seriously, you know, didn't care about a lot of issues, was also, you know, very cantankerous, didn't have a good relationship with his clerks, that, you know, in a sense, Stevens sort of had the sort of good virtues of legal craft. You know, and same thing, you know, Thurgood Marshall is certainly the most admirable figure ever nominated to the Supreme Court, but, you know, it was not really, judging was not really a job that suited him. You know, he was somebody who loved the courtroom, loved legal strategy, and was often, you know, and he was fine because his votes were fine, but, you know, it wasn't really a job that he, you know, that wasn't really his first choice. Whereas Stevens is one of the few justices who was sort of a, you know, a liberal of the top intellectual rank, who never wanted to be president, never wanted to be doing something else. You know, this is really what he wanted to be doing. And I think that for that reason, you know, he was a very, but he also understood that, you know, sort of strategy and thinking things through were not incompatible with the rule of law. So he talks about how, you know, there were a couple cases right after Kennedy came on the court, And there's a sort of, and again, I admire Bill Brennan, but there's this cult around him that he alone among the liberals understood how to put together a majority coalition. You know, but there was a little vanity behind that, starting with the fact that it wasn't that hard to put together majority coalitions in the 60s, the height of the war in court, I mean, for the liberals. But there were a couple of cases after Kennedy joined in which Brennan insisted on keeping the majority opinion in some important Civil Rights Act cases and ended up writing opinions that alienated Kennedy and went the other way. And Stephen says, you know, I always remember that, and that's why Anthony Kennedy wrote every major gay and lesbian rights case. And there was a loss from that in which, you know, by the time Auberge fell, Kennedy, who was the intellectually the weakest man of the coalition, basically just stopped doing constitutional law at all and made shambles out of equal protection doctrine. But Stevens understood that ultimately getting the right result matters, that, you know, he knew he would write a better opinion.
Yeah.
But, you know, he wasn't going to be able to charm Kennedy into writing something else. And so I think that, you know, one of the things Stevens understood is that a commitment to the rule of law means also getting the best result that you can. Sure. You know, he wouldn't have seen that as being in opposition, which I think sometimes people do, that for a judge to behave strategically would just be, but I think Stevens recognized that there was no dichotomy, that taking the rule of law seriously means things like assign an important majority opinion to the weakest member of your coalition, even if it means getting an opinion that's going to be flawed in crucial respects.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And I think, his realism will be best remembered and reflected in the last line of his dissent in Bush against Gore, where he says essentially that the real loser here is going to be public faith in the impartiality of the judiciary. And I think, unfortunately, that prediction is in the course of coming true now. And I think we're going to look back on Bush against Gore as being, in many ways, a absolutely critical watershed moment in the history of American constitutionalism and ultimately in the decline of American constitutionalism. And I don't think that, speaking here from inside the Legal Academy, I don't think that that moment has ever really been fully internalized or appreciated or come to grips with by people within legal academia. Jack Balkin wrote about this, where he wrote an essay in which he asked the question, you know, how is this case going to be remembered? Is it going to be one of these kind of freak cases that sort of get dismissed as being just something that doesn't really fit into the constitutional canon and we can just ignore it? Or will it be something else? And as a matter of doctrine, of course, it is easy to ignore because it itself states that it ought to be ignored and shouldn't be followed as precedent. But as a matter of the politics of law, it was a catastrophe and one which I don't think the institution of the Supreme Court will ever fully recover from. I hate to be so pessimistic, but I do think we're on a long downward spiral now in regard to the function of the courts and judicial review in American life, and it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better.
Yeah, there was one of my favorite essays about Bush versus Gore, which hasn't gotten a lot of attention, although it was very prominent, is Mark Tushnet wrote a little essay about the coming renormalization of Bush versus Gore. I don't know if you've read it. But he starts off by saying that, you know, Bush versus Gore, you know, should mean that critical legal studies has been resurrected from the, you know, from the grave. That this is basically, you know, this, you know, we're, you know, like, you know, it's almost like, you know, you couldn't come up with a fictional scenario better able to sort of, validate the criticism of CLS. And yet he goes through all these different strategies that the legal academy, would use to just sort of pretend that actually things are normal. So one of them is the one, you know, you mentioned, that, you know, just treat it as an anomaly, like the legal tender cases or whatever, that, you know, obviously this has no legal justification, but it was a crisis. You know, what can you do? We move on. The most optimistic one, which I've always liked, is that you know, liberals should start treating Bush versus Gore as if it was constitutional law, given that, you know, a holding, if taken seriously, that, you know, everybody was owed access to the same vote counting procedures and the same, which is actually could have pretty radical implications, which is exactly why the majority of the court wanted to say that the opinion had no precedent. But, you know, it was really because you just went through all those ways that, you know, what's going to be amazing is that on the one hand, Bush versus Gore makes it impossible to deny, you know, the sort of political nature of Supreme Court judging. But on the other hand, there are so many legal academics with a stake in pretending that actually things are OK. And I think that you saw that with the Kavanaugh nomination. You know, as you've pointed out multiple times, what's striking is just the way in which, you know, so many elite legal liberals felt compelled to defend this person, was not only would cast reactionary votes, but was just indistinguished in every way, you know, just not, you know, just nothing remotely impressive about him, even before, you know, all the revelations occurred, you know, despite which should also be an indication that, you know, having taught a guy in a class for a semester isn't really a good indication of his moral character or anything like that, like 10 other ones. But it really strikes me as part of the same phenomenon. So I guess, Paul, I guess I asked, did you have any final thoughts about Stevens' legacy in particular or the broader questions involved?
I mean, my thought is that in my classes, I'm going to increasingly use Stevens as an example of an old vanished world, which shouldn't be romanticized, but which should be appreciated for what it was, especially given what we're now moving into. And I have a considerable affection, you know, for him and for that world because of that. And I think he's also going to be the last man in America who can wear a bow tie without looking like a douche.
Yes, the Tucker Carlson rule. Excellent. Well, Paul, thank you very much for an interesting discussion, which I'm sure we will pick up at a later date as well as potentially on the blog. So thanks very much for listening, everybody. Thanks very much for reading. And thanks very much to our tireless editor, Robert Farley, for helping sort out all the technical aspects. And if you would like to hear more of these, obviously consider donating to our Patreon or any of the other ways of contributing. But feel no obligation. We're just very happy that you've listened. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find good music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through a PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.